Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. With me for the first half of today's show is Severin von Scharner Fleming, a farmer, activist, and organizer based in the Champlain Valley of New York. She is director of Greenhorns, a grassroots organization with the mission to recruit, promote, and support the rising generation of new farmers in America. Severin is also president of Agrarian Trust that works on farmland access issues. She's organizing the upcoming Our Land 2 symposium that takes place in Santa Fe, November 9th through 17th, and focuses on our Acequia Commons here in New Mexico. Good afternoon, Severin, and welcome to Earth Matters.
Thank you so much.
Great. I'm so glad you can make time for us. So, Severin, you've been working to recruit new farmers through your organization, Greenhorns. Why is this such an important task?
Well, obviously, it has to do with Earth Matters. And the project we're involved in is recruiting more brains, bodies, and businesses to get out onto the land and engage in sustainable land management practices. Building the prosperity of a small farm and regional farm economy, and making sure that we have all the skills we need to succeed in those business enterprises. Many of your listeners will know that the average age of the American farmer is hovering around 58, 59, and in ranch world, it's even worse. It's more like 61, 62. So getting the next generation onto the land, even if they're from a city or even if they're, you know, born on a farm, is a pretty big project.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And you're a national organization, right? So you're really doing this. Your mission really is national. Is that right?
Our mission is national and our work is national. We started out by making a documentary film about incoming farmers and the challenges they faced, the challenges and the strategies. And the first year we toured that movie around, I think we toured it into 37 states. It's been screened now over 3,000 times in community screenings around the world. And then from that movie, making the movie to kind of describe and understand the particular challenges facing new growers and new ranchers and farmers, we started producing more and more materials to support their professional development and social network. So we're kind of grassroots organizers and also transmedia producers, making a lot of media for and about and with this entering generation. So from documentary, we went into guidebooks, got guidebooks around finance, about cooperative farming. We have now done 7 years of a weekly podcast interviewing young agrarians. We've worked in different formats with exhibits and kind of stunts, going into Grange Halls and kind of examining the history of the Grange movement and populist sentiments from the 1880s, and onto sailboats to look at watersheds, and using sailboats and maritime history as a way to talk about scale of a more regional farm economy. So we really kind of moved fluidly between new media and old media and sailboats and maritime history museums and Grange Halls and barn dances, everything with the purpose of making a good climate and a happy culture for people who want to do the hard work of growing food in this country.
Wow, fascinating. So Severin, tell us, what are some of the challenges or particular issues that are obstacles to preventing young people from becoming farmers or entering that, you know, career as a farmer or becoming part of the agrarian economy?
Yeah, so there's cultural and economic barriers. There's social barriers. It's not obvious to everybody who might care a lot about the outdoors or want to be their own boss or, you know, is interested in kind of more physical work that they might design themselves a life way into agriculture and into running their own small business. So that, you know, one of the places we notice discouragement happening is college advisors and community college advisors and parents, you know, even saying, well, you know, you wouldn't really make it in agriculture. That's not really a realistic path. So there's figuring out how to find your first farm job and get the skills that you need to farm, not only in terms of growing and, you know, the kind of 3 to 10 year project of learning how to manage the growing operation, vegetables or animals or tree or fruit, but also running a small business or medium business is its own skill set, so business training. A lot of money from the USDA has begun in the last 8 years to come into this sector. The Department of Agriculture says they needed to recruit 100,000 new growers. They didn't say by when, and they only allocate about $17 million a year nationally to do that, but it's a step in the right direction, and that money has been going to fund programs, often in regional sustainable ag organizations, which are really the kind of feeder organizations for this movement, to do business training classes and provide scholarships for regional agricultural conferences to help with a lot of that skills-based stuff. That's the practical side. And then there's also the economic barriers of land. And land is really the fundamental question that we're going to discuss during the symposium. And it's a pretty profound barrier listed, you know, in the top 5 barriers whenever we do a survey. We did one called Building a Future with Farmers that was through the National Young Farmers Coalition, which I'm a co-founder of. Land access remains one of the top barriers for new growers, and that means finding a stable lease, negotiating, having a written lease, figuring out even like informationally where the land is. Obviously, in dry land areas, you know, land that has water is really critical, and how stable that water is. Wells going dry in a lot of places, that's a major issue. And then, of course, how it seems almost impossible to ever think that you could afford to buy land. So the symposium really is to help open up that conversation about land.
Very good. And we'll talk about that here coming up. But give us a sense, Severin, about how you got involved in farming. Since you're a farmer yourself, you know, how'd you get your start in farming, and how did you develop your idea for your organization, Greenhorns?
Yeah, well, I started, like a lot of people, as an apprentice. My first job was as an apprentice on a dairy farm. And then I became a woofer, so that's a willing worker on organic farms. And then I became a full-season apprentice on a CSA in California. And then I went to school and got a degree in agroecology and started my own market garden. But then basically my farming career has been slightly short-circuited by Greenhorns. So I've been pretty much a part-time farmer for the last 4 years after having a market garden and then working part-time on other people's farms. And I did manage a farm startup in New York, but it's definitely a balance being an organizer and being a farmer, and I'm trying to shift back more time into agriculture. A lot of young farmers, though, are in the position of having another full or part-time job along with farming, and either an off-season job in the early part of their careers or a job in the related fields. So a lot of startup farmers have jobs with a land trust or with an ag extension or in some kind of farm services field, just because managing cash flow in these kinds of businesses is challenging. So, you know, wearing many hats is very typical in the young agrarian movement.
Right. And I was fascinated, really, visiting your website about the non-traditional approaches that you employ to recruit new farmers. So you're using art, music, new media. Tell us more about this, and how effective is it to recruiting young people to farming?
Well, we don't have hard data, but we have a big testimonials page on there, and certainly we get a lot of great feedback of people who have used our network to navigate their way into agriculture and to kind of feel comfortable in the decisions that it takes to get embedded on land and in this work. And I think the similar approach that we took with Greenhorns is applicable to this new project with Agrarian Trust. So Greenhorns is coming up on 10 years. National Young Farmers Coalition is now 5 years, almost 6 years. And Agrarian Trust is only 2 years old. And they really flowed one from the other. So when it comes to land issues, that conversation isn't as much about entrepreneur and their path in enterprise, developing the skills and getting on the land, which is a more of a like singular subject or protagonist. Really with land, it's much more of an intersectional or intergenerational issue. And that is because the farmland is owned by someone or someones and is becoming being accessed by someone or some other one. So there's really more stakeholders involved, and that makes it a really important place for an activism that engages all of those stakeholders. And that's kind of the work we are hoping to do. And it's like, if this conference is called Our Land, and you know, we're talking about all of the adjacent and aligned constituencies, from you know, issues of tenure, issues of access, issues of land health, land use, land repair, land ownership. These are the related and, in many cases, highly charged issues that we're dealing with in farmland issues. You know, one thing to just say is, in the U.S., we're more urban than ever, and so the stakeholders, when it comes to farmland, are not just rural people and not just farm families. In terms of recreational and holiday homeowners, in terms of the kind of social finance and capital that's being used to fund a lot of farm startups, in terms of the markets that are available for non-commodity producers, we see that the regional food economy has a value chain that involves a lot more people than just kind of the farmer out there on the farm. And so it feels like the chance to get more people engaged in these large-scale land questions is an important tactic for success.
Right. So for folks who want to check out the Greenhorns website, it's thegreenhorns.net, and there's a lot of great information, films. So it sounds like you're really using the power of new media, film, art, music, really, to get to where young people are, to kind of recruit them here, engage them in these land questions, recruit them into farming.
Yeah, well, helping them, if we can stick with it for the first 3 to 5 years and get over that hump, that's really, from my perspective, one of the critical moments. Is there's great attraction. The question is retention during the, you know, when you're at the real bottom of the food chain and you're just a, you know, lowly laborer. It should be mentioned that an estimated 70% of the agricultural workforce in the United States are not having formal legal status. So, you know, we talk a lot about how farmers are old or farmers are white or farmers are a minority. And, you know, that is if you're talking about farm owners. And I think it's important when we're talking about agriculture to really recognize that we're talking about the workers and the owners. And we need all of them. And when you're a farm worker, it's hard. It's not a very stable place in terms of wages. So whatever your background, coming through the portal of being a farm worker is hard work. And you know, prices of food are too low and prices of labor are too low, and those are related issues. So keeping the morale high is big. And, you know, so like one of the things we have is this cassette tape. You know, most people are driving around in old farm trucks, and so that means that they have a cassette player in there. And so we have a mixtape. We call it the Intergalactic Mixtape of Agrarian Revolt, which are basically peasant songs from around the world. It's little stuff, you know, like that. A lot of barn dances, and yeah, we make short videos.
Yeah, so we're going to take a break. We'll be right back, and we'll talk more about the new generation of young farmers with Severin von Scharner Fleming of Greenhorns and Agrarian Trust. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and your host for today's program. My guest is Severin von Scharner Fleming of the New York-based nonprofit Greenhorns, and we've been talking about recruitment of new farmers and why this is important to the future of agriculture. Severin, in addition to your work with Greenhorns, you're president of Agrarian Trust that works on farmland access issues for next generation farmers. Maybe you can give us just a quick summary of some of the problems with access to farmland and why this is so critical, why Agrarian Trust has taken this on as a key task.
Yeah, Agrarian Trust really grew organically out of Greenhorns and the work in collaboration with other organizations supporting beginning farmers, really running up against a lot of barriers. And those barriers have a lot to do with the kind of cultural context of land relations in this country. So it's estimated that about 60% of farmland leases in the U.S. are verbal leases, kind of non-written leases. So you can compare that to other places, like in Europe. The standard is more like a 7-year lease, which is a contractual lease. So on one hand, you could say, well, we're more of a kind of pioneer-spirited place. We have a larger amount of land. We're not as constrained in terms of the acreage. But that kind of insecurity around land tenure presents some problems when, especially with organic farms, you're investing so much into the land in terms of compost and inputs, infrastructure, paperwork, and, you know, your identity with place. So that kind of getting greater formality of tenure and then having that land, even just getting access to that land, you know, finding the people who own it, negotiating with them properly, getting it at a rate that is affordable, you know, for production agriculture. These are some of the challenges. Another issue that kind of compounds the problem is in the recent times of this kind of stock market up and down, a lot of finance capital and even retirement funds getting involved in farmland purchasing. So the trend of the past 40 years of consolidation and concentration in farm ownership, is just accelerating. Investment in farmland for export commodities, for everything from pecans to dates to hazelnuts to walnuts to wine grapes. There increasingly is capital mobilized to buy up land, invest in infrastructure, and develop these, especially export markets. So all of that is to say the pressures are great and the competition for land is great. So Agrarian Trust really has a three-part focus. One is, you know, expand the community that cares about this issue. It's not enough for it to be an issue of older farmers and younger farmers trying to figure out, you know, an agreement together. It really involves a lot of adjacent and aligned constituencies, and we need to work with them in a more team-like way. I'm talking about conservationists, land conservation community, holiday homeowners, recreational users, watershed thinkers, local economy thinkers, faith communities and hunger communities, and all the people who are interested in more democratic, more local, more secure local food systems. And then a second aspect is helping those stakeholders come to that negotiation with as much support as possible. So template lease agreements and the confidence to get a written lease, to stipulate, you know, the terms of that lease, help in terms of financing. You know, how are you getting going on a path with sustainable cash flow, and, you know, coming into these negotiations with the confidence that you're going to have a buyer, and, you know, you're going to produce a profitable crop off a bigger acreage. And then Lastly, and this is the kind of third part of the mission of Agrarian Trust, is really invoking the commons and recognizing that although private property is, you know, sacrosanct in the American idea, that we are all benefiting from and a part of the Commonwealth, and that our larger landscape, and especially our food-producing landscape, is a limited, precious, irreplaceable Commonwealth of which we are all stakeholders. And so it's from that last principle that this symposium arises, and also our own land trust that we've just formed, which is the Agrarian Land Trust, which essentially will own land and lease it out on lifetime leases affordably, so that that land stays in agriculture and stays in organic agriculture forever, so that we don't keep losing farms and farmland to development and out of local production.
Wow, that's an amazing job you're doing. So let's pick up there and talk specifically about the Our Land 2 symposium that Agrarian Trust is sponsoring. It's going to be held November 9th through the 17th in Santa Fe. And you'll be talking a lot about some of these issues that you've mentioned, and with special emphasis on the commons and specifically the acequia system here in New Mexico. Can you talk more about the purpose of the symposium? Thanks.
Yeah, completely. So we're focusing on the acequia system and really interested in coming onto this landscape and learning from the Southwest and the, you know, resource constraints of dryland agriculture. These lessons are really applicable even in wetter places. And the irrigation commons of the acequia, where all of the beneficiaries of that acequia ditch are all off the ditch, they don't own the water. They have a right to the use of the water and are really in a tight-knit way connected to that infrastructure. So the acequia and the public trust and the commons are the three main themes of the symposium, and it goes on over 6 days, right smack between the Quivira Coalition Conference and the Biodynamic Conference, and we have a session that we're organizing at each of those conferences. And we're, you know, there's a number of programs. One of them is an acequia walk with both young and older farmers and acequia ditch officers talking about the practical administration of their acequia ditch, and that's in Dixon. We have what we call Tragedy of the Commons Film Night, that is grassroots media made about the problems in Flint, Michigan, and in Detroit, as privatization of water supply meant that, you know, a whole city is drinking contaminated water. So the public trust event with our keynote speaker, Mary Wood, who is a law professor in Oregon, she's written a book called Nature's Trust that lays out a framework for better regulation from land use laws to grazing on public lands. And then, of course, our radio host here, Allison, talking about the Gila River, and a woman from the Rainforest Action Network talking about gas and coal drilling on public land. So basically evoking the public trust that we know to be the framework that governs our legal commons, our public lands, and extending that out as a notion to start including more of our food production commons. So, and there's a couple other events, but I don't want to take all the time.
Right. And how do people find out more about the symposium? You've got the full schedule online, is that right?
Full schedule is online at agrariantrust.org/2016symposium. And I'm really hoping people who are challenged by this or interested in land issues to come along. And, you know, one thing that's really true from the young agrarian movement is so many of these new farm businesses and the sustaining of existing farm businesses is a result of teamwork by non-farmers, by the network of connection and kinship and kind of collusion in supporting these regional farm businesses. So for those of you who are interested in these kinds of issues, I just would love to encourage you to come, attend, connect, become, inspired, but also remember that your agency in connecting land that wants to be farmed with people who want to farm it can often be the first step to something really wonderful happening on the land.
Okay, Severin von Scharner Fleming, thank you for joining us today and sharing with us the important work you're doing for the future sustainability of our agricultural systems. And I look forward to joining you at the Arland 2 Symposium in Santa Fe, November 9th through 17th. And again, visit agrariantrust.org for the full symposium schedule and lots more resources and information. So we'll be right back after this short break, and we'll be talking with Miguel Santisteban of Sol Feliz Farm in Taos, New Mexico, about New Mexico's acequia system, intergenerational transfer of agricultural knowledge, and more. Don't go away. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and your host for today's program. Joining me for the second half of today's show is farmer Miguel Santisteban of Sol Feliz Farm in Taos and a parciante on the Acequia Madre del Sur del Rio de Don Fernando de Taos. Miguel is director of the nonprofit Agriculture Implementation Research and Education and a longtime advocate for conservation of traditional agriculture and a relationship with land, water, and culture. Good afternoon, Miguel, and welcome to Earth Matters.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
Great. Glad you could take the time to talk with us today. So, Miguel, you've been farming for 20 years. How'd you get involved in agriculture?
Well, I was in Albuquerque. I was in college, an undergrad, studying biology. And I was familiar with a group in town called the Atrisco Land Rights Council, and another group called Tonantzin Land Institute. But the Atrisco Land Rights Council had a community garden they did in the South Valley at a place, I think they called it the Larazolo Farm, and they needed somebody to coordinate the farm. And I was a volunteer on their organization, and, and I told them I don't have any experience farming, but if somebody guides me, I'm willing to do the legwork for the community garden there. And so Jaime Chavez, he's still involved in agriculture in the region. He connected me with all the people I needed to connect with. I believe I got the seed from his father in the North Valley, blue corn and green chile, and we put manure on the field there, and it was just a crash course in agriculture, and it was a good season. I got some of my friends involved, and we did the farming that season. We had a harvest festival, I made chicos for the first time, and I have a link on my website where people could read more about it, but it was a profound experience, and I knew from that day forward that I would be planting for the rest of my life, and lo and behold, 28 or so years later, I still am. I believe, 22 years later. Yeah. I even took corn with me to my graduate program at UC Davis, and I planted a garden with the students at DQ University, and hopefully some of them still have that seed. But yeah, I consider myself an agriculture monster. I put in gardens in a lot of places, several places in the South Valley of Albuquerque, Chimayo, several places here in Taos. I've helped out with a lot of other community gardens in California, like I say. So I'm hooked, I'll be farming as long as I can. My body is starting to tell me that I have certain cricks and pains that I got to deal with, but nothing a little yoga can't fix. So I'm still at it. I had a good season this year. You can read about it at my blog. That's at www.growfarmers.org. And, talking about the challenges this year, it's been a kind of a strange year. A lot of grasshoppers. And, strange weather, of course, you talk about climate change at some point. But lo and behold, you know, I got a good harvest. I'm happy with how everything turned out. You know, it's typical on my Aseca. We ran out of water in at the end of June. So usually I switch to a dry land system, but this year was the first year that I put all, even my corn. You know, that to me it was sacrilege in years past to put corn on drip irrigation because I understand it as a drought-tolerant crop. But, you know, I couldn't afford to take chances. So I put in a lot of work into my field. So, you know, I laid drip lines this year, and I'm still trying to identify my strongest crops for seed saving. You know, that's a lot of what I do is crop seed saving and crop adaptation.
I hope we can talk about that here in a little bit. And so tell us about your farm, Sol Feliz Farm in Taos, and all the crops that you're growing. And you're on the Acequia system, right?
Yes, I'm like you said, I'm on Acequia Madre del Sur, you know, arguably the oldest Acequia in Taos. There's others that probably would lay claim to that, but this land that I'm farming, you know, I live in the house that my grandfather built, and I understand on my dad's side, my Santi Esteban lineage was the ones who helped found this land grant. I think it was like 60 families came and founded the San Fernandez de Taos land grant in maybe the 1600s, because I hear that we were here before the Pueblo Revolt, but then the Santi Estevans moved to another land grant, the La Loma land grant, and I actually ended up back on this piece of land on my mom's lineage, so the Trujillos, who came here when this became Mexico in the 1830s. So I've been on this land. It's not a lot of land, you know, I only farm maybe a third of an acre. But the adjoining properties are in my family, my mom and my aunt, so I put in plots over there as well. So probably in total, I'm farming about an acre. You know, I really focus on the traditional crops. I wrote my master's thesis on traditional crops and maize traditions, you know, corn food traditions, and the Acequia. So I was able to collect a lot of seeds from the old-timers. So, you know, I grow the white corn. I grow the maíz concho, you know, there's two white corns, or actually three of them, and I'm one of the few people who know the different, the nuances of the crops around here, but I like to grow the rarest, well, not the rarest, would be the maíz blanco, the pinini variety, the old popcorn variety, but I'm growing the maíz concho, that's for grinding, it's for pozole and for tamales. But I also have the Red Umbroso, that's for chicos, and a chaquewe, you know, traditional foods of this area, and of course, blue corn. I have a native sweet corn, several popcorns, and a yellow corn, you know, and I just rotate all the corns through and try and keep them current. You know, I'm really working on the blue corn and the white corn because that's what I feed my family. And I got several kinds of beans. You know, the bolita beans are traditional to this area, but there's also a frijol amarillo, a yellow bean that I've conserved, and other legumes. You know, garbanzos are traditional to this area, so are fava beans, and of course, we have two varieties of peas. We have the alberjón dulce, that's a sweet pea, but also the alberjón de bolita, that's like a soup pea or a field pea. And yeah, I have a lot of success with those crops. You know, I've been looking for the ancestral lentils, you know, and I found an old man who had like six lentils at the bottom of a bag of beans, but they weren't viable. And I got some other lentils from an old woman up in Cerro, north of Cuesta, and those also weren't viable. So I'm on the lookout for the traditional lentils. I've acclimatized, you know, some lentils I found at a seed exchange. But they weren't traditional lentils, you know, they weren't traditional to this region. So, you know, I'm growing those kinds of crops. And then I grow like amaranth, and I have like three kinds of amaranth. I have the red amaranth, the golden amaranth, and I even have a green one that I've never grown out. But I might be growing that out. And I'm really into grains, you know, I finally grew some quinoa, and I acclimatized some millet. And I have some barley out here. I have some wheat. I have an old variety of red wheat, hard winter wheat. So those are the kinds of crops I'm into. You know, this year I did go out and save some cucumbers, some chile, you know, a chimayo, Chile that I've been acclimatizing to this area. And then the real one that I'm real happy about this year that's getting me the most excited is I found a traditional melon from Picoris Pueblo called the Melon Mexicano. And but I'm going to have to back breed it out because I think it crossed with cantaloupe or honeydew somewhere, because all the melons look different, but I have an idea of which one is true to type. So so I'm going to be breeding that one in the years to come. You know, that's what makes agriculture exciting to me, is trying out crops and seeing how they do. And then the ones that do good, you grow them out, you save those seeds, and you grow them out another year. And then they do better, and then you choose the best ones, and then you grow them out again, and they do even better. And then, you know, and then all of a sudden you get hit with a drought, and there's no water. You know, the acequia went dry, and I didn't have the means to do drip irrigation in the past. And lo and behold, these crops survive. I've experienced, you know, I would even go so far as to call it miraculous. You know, it seems impossible that some of these crops would survive through this godforsaken drought, you know, period that we've had of just extreme dryness where the soil is cracking and the crops are withering and yellowing, and they just look like they are not having a good time. But then you come to the harvest and you're like, wow, you know, they produced. They're smaller, you know, they're stunted, but they produce. And then, like I say, you grow them again the next year, and then it's just even more amazing. So I'm hooked on all this agriculture stuff. I hope I can do it for lifetimes upon lifetimes.
So, Miguel, you've been telling us about, you know, your research and development of what I think is called adaptive seed. So explain to us the process, but why is this so important to the sustainability of our food systems? And I'm really wondering, like, you're doing all the seed saving, and are you sharing your seeds with farmers in your, you know, in your area?
Yeah, you know, I do trades with a lot of hunters, mostly. Mostly the hunters are interested in trading with me because they're, you know, they're busy hunting and I'm busy farming. So then I get meat from the hunters, and then, you know, I give them seed. I don't usually go to seed exchanges. Sometimes I do. I like to, you know, have a connection with people before we exchange seed. And, you know, I am looking. I know there's some seed laws, and I'm looking at how I can be, like, a legitimate seed type of selling person. So I'm looking into that. But, you know, saving seed is real important. I mean, you know, seed saving is fundamental to agriculture. You know, in years past, everybody was saving seed. That was the process of developing all these crops. But now in the modern age, everybody's buying seed. So, and buying seeds is great, you know, for people who don't have the ability to save them and things of that nature. But what ends up happening is, if, especially if you're buying hybrids, and maybe some people are even getting GMOs, but you can't really save those seeds. You know, they're either not biologically fit to save seed, or there could even be legal issues with GMOs. So, you know, the open pollinated, the old varieties of seeds, you know, they start to get acclimatized to an area and start to differentiate themselves by the area, you know. So, and eventually you would call these heirlooms because they're special to an area, and then eventually you would call them a landrace, something that's totally acclimatized to an area. And like here in Taos Valley, you know, we have like 6 rivers and 50 acequias or 80 acequias. And so it could be said that every community has a specialized toolbox of crops that goes to that ancestral type of relationship with the land and the farmers and the techniques that are even the water, you know. And it's kind of like an epigenetic thing, you know, the environment triggers certain qualities or characters in the plant, in the crops, and then they just get more and more specialized. And, you know, you go through a hard time, and maybe you'll lose 10%, 30%, 50% of your harvest, but then you know that the harvest that survived is attuned to those climatic changes, is attuned to whatever happened, and then you would have a greater success, you know, in the coming years of using those seeds that you saved.
Right.
So that, just trying to get back to the roots of agriculture, you know, in my opinion, from an ecological perspective, you know, we're in a mutualism or a symbiotic relationship, you know, us humans being representatives of the animal kingdom and crops being representative of the plant kingdom. And, you know, so I think it's fundamental to us being human and having culture and language and dance and music and song. I think all that stuff comes back to our relationship with each other, our relationship to the land, and, of course, with the water and the seed, and how all those things kind of tie together and create all of our respective cultures in the world.
This is fascinating stuff, Miguel. We'll be right back after this short break, and we'll talk more with Miguel Santisteban of Sol Feliz Farm. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest is Miguel Santisteban of Sol Feliz Farm and Agriculture Implementation Research and Education, and we've been talking about the acequia system for managing agricultural surface water supply. And Miguel, let's kind of pick up on that. Maybe you could explain to our listeners how the acequias work. They're, you know, long-term systems for managing surface water. So tell us generally how they work.
So acequias are basically gravity-fed flood irrigation. You know, there's cultures all over the world that have similar types of irrigation, you know, here in the Southwest and all over. I've heard about them in Bali and the Philippines and in all kinds, all over the Middle East, Central Asia. But we call them acequias, and I understand the word acequia is an Arabic word. And like a lot of our traditions are coming from desert regions of the world, or water sharing. And, you know, when you say the word acequia, you're talking about the ditch itself, you know, es una acequia. But you're also talking about the community that manages it. You know, it's a tight-knit community. We all have to get together once a year and clean the ditch, and if something happens, you know, a flash flood or something, then the mayordomo will call us to help out if he needs that type of help or she needs that type of help. And so, you know, the community manages this system. We elect a mayordomo now that we're part of the United States. We also elect a commission. So the commission is a secretary, a treasurer, and a president. You know, I've served as mayordomo and as president on my acequia. You know, now we're getting into issues of water rights and things of that nature, but basically, you know, the mayordomo oversees the whole system. You know, our system in particular, we have five different ditches. It's about 6 miles of acequia. It takes us 1 or 2 days to clean the whole system, and then we are able to run the water through the whole system. And at the beginning of the season, you know, it's all gravity fed and there's a lot of water in the river. It's runoff, snowmelt. And so, you know, all the ditches are full and everybody is getting to irrigate. You know, you almost don't even have to ask the mayordomo, but of course you do. And so you get your turn on the list. You know, the mayordomo will tell you if it's a good time to take the water or not. And you kind of let him know your schedule. And you know, and you get the water for however many days proportional to the amount of land you have. You know, like earlier I said, I got about 1 acre. So I'll get the water for a full day. You know, and usually I can get the water for a full day once a week or once every 10 days, depends on the demand. You know, we all have to share, we all have to take turns, and we all have to defer and respect our mayordomo and the schedule he or she's trying to keep. And then the water starts to run out, you know, and like I say, our river is going dry in July. So as the water diminishes, then the mayordomo gets more strict about how he or she is distributing it. You know, once when we had a really bad drought, I was distributing the water in 4-hour increments and, you know, telling one person they have the water from 6 to 10 a.m., another person from 10 to 2 p.m., and another person from 2 to 6 p.m., and, you know, and a week later, there was no water. It was physically impossible for us to irrigate. So, you know, and then you're on your own, I guess, you know. There's a saying around here that says, es más importante escardar y arrimar la tierra que regar, which translates to, it's more important to cultivate your soil and bring soil to your plants than it is to irrigate. You know, there's another saying around here that says, el mejor húmedo para las plantas es el sudor del frente, which translates to, you know, the best irrigation for your crops is the sweat of your brow. So, you know, those types of methods of switching from, you know, having abundant water in the acequias to switching over to an al temporal or secano, is what we call dry land agriculture on here. You know, that's embedded in the culture. You know, nowadays people are measuring agriculture by cuts of hay and bales of alfalfa. And so it's creating another dimension on the water sharing because people are looking at water in a different way, you know. But, you know, I make the argument that that's not really traditional agriculture because in years past we didn't have the physical capability of diverting the water into our acequias come July or August. So, you know, the hydrograph to me is looking more like it used to look 100 years ago. You know, now we're able to divert every drop of water because we have a concrete dam, a presa, engineered by the Army Corps of Engineers, But if there was water, we could divert it all. But then what happens is there's not enough water. So, you know, traditionally we were always switching to a dry land style of agriculture. Our crops were adapted to that. You know, now we have a different type of agriculture happening. So, you know, at some point we're going to have to adapt to that. You know, the rubber's going to hit the road, so to speak, you know, with climate change and water demands. But yeah, I think the way to be resilient in the face of drought, in the face of uncertainty of climate change, you know, those methods exist in the acequia system. And again, you know, the acequia system is worldwide. You find it all over Spain and Iberia. You find it all over Northern Africa and the Middle East, you know, Afghanistan. So all these areas, you know, their traditional agriculture practices could really inform the challenges we're going to have in the future, I think, with food security.
Right. And Miguel, you're also involved in education. You're director of the nonprofit Agriculture Implementation Research and Education. So you're doing a lot of education with youth and conserving local food traditions. Give us a sense of kind of the programs that you're doing.
Yeah, you know, I have a curriculum that I'm developing and hoping to push that further, you know, do some video work with that and work with more schools. You know, I sometimes just drop in. I don't drop in. You know, we schedule this. But, like, for example, today I was at Cuesta Middle School and talking about the watershed and acequias and to a group of eighth graders. And then, you know, they went and did other water testing and things like that. So I like to support the local teachers. I used to be a teacher myself, a science and math teacher. And I used to juggle those two worlds, you know, being a nonprofit director and an educator. But now really trying to focus on the nonprofit and do some education work. You know, in the future I'll be doing a schedule of workshops. You know, I do have groups come out to the farm, a lot of UNM groups, you know, that come from Albuquerque. And I'll give them tours of the farm. You know, I've been teaching and doing permaculture for about 22 years as well. I was a graduate of the first Native American permaculture design course, which is like on its 21st or 22nd year. And I've been practicing permaculture ever since. So, you know, I have this framework of teaching agriculture. It's very simple. You know, I make the argument that a person can do agriculture. The only tool you need is really a good hoe or a good shovel. And like I say, some strong seed. And basically we focus on the three areas, you know, which would be soils, which is how you manage your soils with organic matter and compost and vermicompost and biochar, how you manage your water. You know, if you manage your soils properly, well, then your water, your soil acts as a sponge, so then you can have more soil moisture, but also looking at different styles of irrigation, everything from using sand and cobble mulch, you know, which will condense humidity in the atmosphere, or using unglazed clay pots, or, you know, taking it to the modern age, doing drip irrigation and relying on that outside type of infrastructure, but will ensure your productivity, you know, to a certain degree. And then the other leg of the triangle is, of course, the seed. So then we teach about all the different kinds of seeds, and we teach how to process them, you know, wet processing, dry processing, root cellaring, and all the different techniques of adapting crops and saving seed. And I'm really trying to formalize the curriculum and offer it, you know, so people could sign up. I've mostly been just on the reactionary end. You know, groups know about me, And, you know, UC Santa Cruz has come out here, a bunch of schools from Boulder and Denver area come out here. Like I say, UNM Taos. Now I'm starting to develop a relationship with Northern in Española. And yeah, so people can get on my website and they can get a group together and we can organize something.
Miguel, you're going to be speaking at the upcoming Our Land 2 Symposium, November 9th through the 17th, being held in Santa Fe, and you'll be talking about intergenerational transfer of knowledge as it relates to farming. Tell us why this is important.
You know, I've been doing a lot of youth programs over the years through different entities. You know, I've worked for Hands Across Cultures out of Española. I've worked for the New Mexico Azteca Association. I've been an educator myself. La Jicarita Enterprise Community, and now, of course, my own nonprofit. So, you know, the question is how do we get kids to be involved in the acequias? You know, the average age of an acequia farmer is the same as a national farmer, you know, 60s or 70s. And so we're trying to address that issue. So at the Quivira Coalition, I'm just going to be sharing all the models that we've employed over the years. You know, different mentorship models, different educational programs, you know, trying to engage the families who are doing agriculture and trying to engage kids who might not have a chance to do agriculture. And so just looking at all the different programs and different ways that people are trying to figure out how to bring the next generation into agriculture. And this is especially important now with the acequias because, you know, water is becoming in demand, especially here in Taos. We have the Apeta water settlement that's going to create a water market. So it's almost like we're racing the clock. Like we're trying to get to the youth before the water brokers get to, you know, we're trying to get to the youth and get them on the acequias before the water brokers get the water rights.
Makes a lot.
So it's a really relevant, exercise right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Miguel Santisteban, thank you for talking with me today about New Mexico's acequia system, farming, and the important work that you're doing in northern New Mexico to conserve our land, water, ecosystems, and culture.
Excellent. Thank you. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, so that's all the time we have today. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. For a podcast of today's program, visit the Earth Matters program page online at gmcr.org. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio 89.1 FM.